newspaper reporter, my father said, "I always feel a little funny during these interviews. I was on the other side of them for so many years, asking the questions." Dad mentioned our collaboration to the reporter, saying he thought it would be published in the spring of 1986. Many of the interruptions involved construction work that was going on around us, questions from contractors or from Jan, who was redecorating the entire interior of the house, section by section, with new carpet, marble, tile, countertops, window treatments, appliances, and fixtures. Electrically operated shades were being installed over the insides of the glass dome, at great expense. The home had many roof leaks when Dad bought it, so re-roofing was one of the first priorities. Still, after the new roof was finished, he worried, and during the first heavy rainfall he checked every room, luckily finding no problems. That night, he told me later, it rained cats. He thought for a moment, and his eyes twinkled. And cats. A dog wouldn't go out on a night like that. By the third week of July, we were on a roll with Man of Two Worlds. Dad agreed to delete a number of his passages that I didn't like, and he went along with my suggested substitutions. He concurred with almost all of my recommendations, but said I was too expository on occasion, that I should leave more to the imagination of the reader. We went over characterizations carefully, fine-combing each scene to make certain our people acted within their motivations, with actions that advanced the plot. Much of the material we reviewed was his first draft work, and I was impressed by the quality, especially considering the rapid pace at which he wrote and the fact that he wasn't feeling well. Incorporating his material, I typed an outline of all the scenes, which I kept handy. Dad was impressed at the way I used it to access scenes we needed to find. Very often, my supposedly primitive method was faster than the search function on the computer. Sometimes Dad and I did role-playing games to draw out characters, seeing how they might react to the situations in which we placed them. The dialogue went back and forth, and when we liked the way it was going, we wrote it down. At the end of July 1985, when we were not quite finished, he had to go to a writing seminar in Bryan Head, Utah, where he and Bill Ransom were teaching. We planned to finish the book upon their return, before Dad and Teresa left on August 12th for a month-long trip to Hawaii, Australia, and Hong Kong. On August 6th, the day after Dad returned from Utah, we resumed work on Man of Two Worlds. His stomach continued to make growling noises, and he took occasional drinks of a thick, chalky liquid to settle it, complaining about the bad taste. He admitted he was in considerable intestinal pain and was taking high-potency painkiller medication, which worried me. Thursday, August 8th, 1985, was our longest day. We tended the printer and made corrections through the end of the book on page 565. During a break, he shared a hard-to-find Echt Polliner beer with me, his last bottle. He wore a navy blue pullover shirt and blue jeans, but in the evening changed into a regal red velvet robe. His glasses had black rims, and as he looked through their lenses that night at the green illuminated computer screen, his head shook a little from side to side. The constant, apparently involuntary motion I had noticed previously, perhaps from fatigue. When we were still at it past midnight, I reflected on how wonderful it was to be working beside my father, this great and learned man. I watched him leaning over the computer screen, punching buttons to cut words from a paragraph. Whenever we added material, he tried to find somewhere on the page where he could cut, so that the page numbering would not be altered. I was amazed at the way virtually any paragraph could be cut, without harming the quality of the writing. He felt this process actually improved the writing. This man, whom I had once disliked, had been so generous in recent years, helping immeasurably with my writing and entrusting me with the management of his financial affairs. Considering the bad start in our relationship, I have never heard of anyone who tried harder to get to know his eldest son, or who changed more than he did. The effort was late, but at least he made it. Now he was working in pain, and I was growing increasingly worried about him. Others in the family were equally concerned. As we finished up in the wee hours of the morning, except for some minor corrections remaining, Dad asked, "What day is this? Wednesday?" "It's Friday." "Friday?" He rubbed his eyes, mentioned something about having to run some important errands later in the day, and that we would get together again afterward. We said our goodnights, and he trudged off to bed. As I drove home on the empty dark streets, a light mist fell. The next afternoon I helped him with the final corrections. When it was done and we had a ready-to-mail manuscript, Dad walked out of his study while I collected my notes. In the hallway, he let out a relieved and exuberant "Wooey!" As we chattered in the kitchen, he said the book might hit, meaning the bestseller lists. He spoke of a sequel, and we tossed around a couple of ideas, mentioning the characters we hadn't killed off yet. We agreed to celebrate the book's completion after his overseas trip. "We'll have reaction from my publisher by then," he said. We were both exhausted. Shortly before leaving on his trip, Dad gave Jan and me long lists of tasks he wanted us to complete in his absence, involving the ongoing interior decorating work and a number of other matters. When Dad and Teresa returned on September 10th, he looked jaunty in a wide-brimmed Australian Outback hat. He was tired but in good spirits and shared many funny jokes he had heard in recent weeks. I told him the feedback I had received from the people in New York who were publishing our book, that 2 out of 3 editors loved it, while a third thought we had begun extremely well and then lost course a bit. The editors had suggestions for changes, which we set to work on. These were relatively minor, but would take several weeks. On the second day back, my father went to Group Health Hospital for tests, saying his stomach was still bothering him, and he had lost weight and energy. When I looked at him closely, I noticed that he was pale and drawn. Still, he was in a good mood, with his sense of humor unbowed. When Jan said something to him at dinner about economy airfares, he quipped, "I took a budget flight once. I had to bring my own folding chair." On his 65th birthday, October 8th, 1985, Dad showed me the cover proof for Man of Two Worlds, which Putnam had just sent to him. We agreed that it was well done, though privately I noticed a Dune feel to it. I commented that my name was in lettering of equal size to his, and Dad said, "That's right. I arranged to have it this way." We spent the morning working on Man of Two Worlds revisions. My shoulder and neck were bothering me, and Dad's stomach was really acting up. He said he wasn't processing fats, that they made him ill, and he was having to eat extremely lean foods. He had to watch what he ate at his birthday dinner. A few days later, we completed our novel and mailed it to New York. Thereupon, I set to work on Prisoners of Arion, my uncompleted science fiction novel. Later in the month, Dad and I were in my car on an errand, and he said his film agent, Ned Brown, was going to seek a large amount of additional money from Dino De Laurentiis, since De Laurentiis had allegedly used portions of 2 books, Dune and Dune Messiah, in the movie, but only paid for the rights to use 1. This involved the use of a key Dune Messiah character in the film version of Dune, Edric, the Spacing Guild steersman. Because of Frank Herbert's poor health, the issue was dropped, without ever having been resolved. Dad said Universal had lost money on the movie, but De Laurentiis had made a bundle on the venture, a profit of $30 to $40 million. I didn't see how that could be possible. Dino De Laurentiis does not agree with this statement. A few years ago, he indicated to Mary Alice Keir, the literary and film agent for the Herbert Limited Partnership, that he, like Universal, had lost money on Dune. I am only reporting what Frank Herbert said, and cannot comment one way or another on details of the accounting. My father began to refer to his medical condition as an intestinal malady. It might be one of a half a dozen parasites, he thought, possibly acquired in Mexico in 1983 during the filming of the opening scenes of the movie. Just to play it safe, Group Health was going to perform a biopsy, inserting a long fiber optic tube down his throat and taking a bite out of his small intestine. His weight was down 20 pounds in recent months to 150, and he looked thin. By Wednesday, October 30th, 1985, I had developed a bad case of flu and congestion, in addition to my continuing shoulder and neck problems, which I thought might have something to do with stress. In fact, I couldn't recall the last time I hadn't felt high stress. Slowly, without warning, it seemed to have crept up on me. A lot of it had to do with my concern over Dad. He spent the day going back and forth to group health facilities in Seattle and Redmond with specimens, along the same highways and roads my mother had traveled when she was so ill. That afternoon, he telephoned with good news on Man of Two Worlds. In addition to our sale to Berkeley Putnam, a big foreign publisher, Victor Gallants, wanted to publish it in the United Kingdom. At preschool the next day, Margot, just shy of her fourth birthday, became terrified of the costumes other children were wearing. It was Halloween. She had to sit in the headmistress's office during a party, eating cookies and drinking milk. That afternoon, we stopped by Dad's and gave him a plate of cookies. He gave us a pumpkin he had carved for Margot and some pumpkin seeds he had roasted in the oven, referring to them by the Mexican name, semillas. It brought back old memories. That evening, I dialed the phone for Margot, and she thanked Pop-Pop for the special pumpkin. Margot felt very close to her grandfather. Even when he didn't have the patience to be around her for long periods, he tried to be sweet and invariably gave her a hug and a kiss. He got a big kick out of her nickname for him. By the first week of November, doctors were telling Dad they thought he had Crohn's disease, a chronic intestinal disorder that sometimes involved inflammation and sometimes other problems. If he did have one of the forms of this malady, it looked as if it had been caught early, which was good. It was treatable with sulfa drugs, and doctors were speculating that the condition might have lain dormant in him, surfacing after the stresses of Mom's death. On Saturday, November 9th, I visited Dad, and he looked very weak and fragile. He said he was down to 140 pounds, and I noticed with alarm that his handwriting was shaky. The house, with construction activity still going full tilt, was noisy, dusty, and depressing. Scaffolds had been set up inside the high dome area, and as I looked around, it seemed to me that Dad had taken on too much for his age and condition. Normally, he liked to have things under construction as a creative outlet when he had finished writing for the day, or when he took breaks from his study. But now, with everything torn apart, he was too sick to keep up with what he had begun. That evening, he was watching Dune on cable television, but fell asleep during it. We teased him about this. His own movie. 2 days later, he was feeling a little better and started working seriously on Dune 7, as yet unnamed. To begin, this involved carefully reviewing the other 6 books in the series for the threads he wanted to continue in the new work. He used a yellow highlighter pen, with which he marked key passages in the books. After a few days, Dad told me he didn't have Crohn's disease. Now the doctors thought it was diverticulitis, a colon inflammation treatable with the same medicine he had been taking. He sounded ill at ease, and I could tell that the continuing uncertainty was bothering him. Penny had been trying to obtain information from Dad in order to help him, but he wasn't always forthright. Finally, he admitted to her that there was a CAT scan problem, something that had turned up, and so he had to undergo more tests involving needle biopsies. On the 22nd of November, 1985, Dad called in the morning while I was writing and told Jan that Group Health had discovered 2 small spots of cancer in his liver, each approximately 1/2 inch wide. He said they were recommending chemotherapy and added that they still had not figured the intestinal problem out. Jan said she would bring me to the phone, but he did not want to disturb me. 10 inches of snow had fallen the night before, and when I called my father back a short while later, he answered with surprising cheer, saying, "And a snowy good morning to you." He possessed, among other attributes, tremendous courage, not unlike that of my mother. "I've been leading an interesting life," he said, in reference to an ancient Chinese curse that no longer seemed funny to me. "May you lead an interesting life." The following Monday afternoon, Dad reported that his liver problem was adenocarcinoma, which alarmed me. "I'll have to undergo chemotherapy," he said, "which means nausea and hair loss. After Bev went through the suffering of her initial treatments, she told me, the mind has a marvelous capacity to forget. I'm going to keep that in mind." He paused and added, "It's funny, Brian, but I don't feel too bad about this. They caught it early." I recommended that he obtain a second opinion before undergoing chemotherapy because of side effects, but he didn't feel that was necessary. Dr. Bill Shire, his friend from Port Townsend, called that evening. Jan got on the line with us, and the doctor said, "Don't listen to what he's saying about catching it early. Once it's in the liver, a person's in big trouble. It's going to get worse before it gets better. He's in tough, and I thought you should know what's going on. He said chemotherapy had not been successful in the past in treating adenocarcinoma of the liver, so he had convinced Dad to obtain a second opinion from an oncologist at Swedish Hospital in Seattle, which had an excellent department for the treatment of cancer. They had computer hookups to other facilities around the world, permitting them to determine state-of-the-art treatments for each disease type. He said the emphasis in diagnosis now would be in determining the primary source of the cancer, which at this point was unknown. If the primary source was in the liver, that would be very bad, so he hoped it was in a more treatable place, such as the colon. In a dismal mood, I responded that each time we got news on Dad, it seemed to grow worse and worse. We thanked Dr. Shire for his concern and honesty, and especially for the invaluable counseling he was giving my father. On Tuesday, November 26th, Jan and I were snowbound, since Dad had borrowed our tire chains several months before without telling us. Now he wanted me to drive him back and forth to the clinics for tests, but I couldn't get out to do it. I telephoned every dealer in the Seattle area looking for chains, thinking I could have a taxi deliver them. But all the chains were sold out. Penny and Ron came to his aid all the way from Port Townsend with their four-wheel drive truck and chains. By the 1st of December, after the snowiest November on record in the region, the weather was beginning to warm. The roads were clearing, and we were able to get over to Dad's place, where Jan and I lunched with him and Teresa. We had soup and sandwiches. In a surprisingly good mood, Dad said Penny called from Port Townsend to say she was having trouble with a skunk that got into the greenhouse through the cat's pet door. The whole house was acquiring an aroma. Desperate, she asked Dad if he had an old-fashioned skunk remedy. To this he quipped, "I think you can still find some old-fashioned clothespins for sale in Port Townsend." He told me his intestinal disorder was dramatically improved, and that he was eating regular food again. Doctors were still performing tests, however, trying to locate the source of the cancer spots in his liver. We discussed traction devices for the snow, and I mentioned a bucket of kitty litter I was keeping in the car to get in and out of difficult parking areas. He mentioned a trick of his own father's from the 1930s. Pour Clorox on the tire treads, thus softening the rubber and providing improved traction. On Wednesday, December 4th, temperatures were warmer, into the mid-40s, and most of the snow had thawed. I struggled in the morning to build up a head of steam on Prisoners of Arion, and finally pulled 7 typewritten pages out of the air. 1,750 words. That was pretty good for me, as my usual day of first-draft typing produced around 4 pages, 1,000 words. Often when I felt the worst in the morning, I had a good day of writing, starting out slowly and then getting on a roll, as if I was able to tap a deep reservoir of strength in the struggle to produce. I went to visit Dad at 1:30 that afternoon. When I entered his study at the rear of the house, he smiled at me and closed a paperback copy of Chapter House Dune that he had been highlighting in yellow. He wore a red plaid Pendleton shirt and said he was feeling pretty good, that his weight was up to 152 pounds. Doctors had completed their tests, he said, and had pinpointed the pancreas as the primary source of his cancer. At the time, I had no idea what I was hearing, how serious it was. But I didn't like the sound of it. He described a new hyperthermic cancer treatment at the University of Wisconsin Medical Center in Madison, Wisconsin, learned about through the computer network at Swedish Hospital. He said it involved using radiant heat and water vapor to induce fevers of up to 108 degrees Fahrenheit, heating the blood. Dad and Teresa would be leaving the following Sunday. The doctors wanted him to be physically strong before undergoing treatment, so in Madison they would give him treadmill and other tests before proceeding. He expected to remain there for 10 days or so if they accepted him for treatment, and added that he would have to go back once a month for the next 6 months. This treatment would be administered in conjunction with a type of chemotherapy that didn't result in hair loss or other undesirable side effects. "I'd rather not get sick to get well," he said. The out-of-state procedure was extremely expensive, and he said his group health medical insurance would not cover it due to its experimental nature. He was investigating his Medicare coverage since he had just turned 65, but didn't think that would apply either. He said the hyperthermic treatment was frontier medicine, but that results for his type of cancer in other people had been encouraging. He emphasized that his cancer had been discovered early, and his tone was upbeat. "When we come into this world, we're given a death sentence anyway," he added, with an impish wink. Considering his suffering in recent months, I was concerned that the disease had not been discovered all that early, but I said nothing. At least he seemed optimistic, and I thought this would carry him through the difficult times ahead. He had a strong will to fight, to survive. He also had a sweetness about him in this difficult time, and a quieter, more pensive way. Most of the time he wasn't his old blustery, exuberant self, but occasional flashes of it gave us hope. The day after Dad arrived in Wisconsin, he told me by telephone that doctors in Seattle had given him a 25% chance of survival. But his doctor at the University of Wisconsin said, "Oh, you have a much better chance than that." The University of Wisconsin had only treated 25 or 30 patients under the experimental program, and only one with similar pancreatic and liver conditions. That particular patient responded well and survived the treatment, but did suffer a side effect, a nervous system problem. They felt they could avoid such side effects with Dad through a once-weekly treatment for 4 successive weeks and other modifications. Indications from the medical team were that Dad appeared to be strong enough for the rigors of the program, but he would be in the hospital for a couple of days undergoing a battery of tests. On Friday, December 13, 1985, an editorial assistant telephoned from G.P. Putnam's Sons, saying she was mailing the Man of Two Worlds galleys out for author's corrections, and that she needed them back by the first week of January. She said she would mail Dad's copy to him in Wisconsin, and that publication was scheduled for April 1986.
When I spoke with Dad the next day, he said he was starting hyperthermia on Monday, with chemotherapy beginning 2 days after that. There would be 4 weeks of treatment through January 4, 1986. 4 hyperthermias and 4 chemotherapies.
Then, from January 19th through February 2nd, they had 3 more of each scheduled.
My father went into his first hyperthermia session on December 16th and did extremely well, with his heart rate only accelerating to 120 beats per minute, better than a 31-year-old jogger who underwent the same procedure.
Frank Herbert surprised the doctors with a number of quips, causing them to laugh. One, while his head was sticking out of a heating chamber, was, "What you see is what you get." I often sent him humorous messages, including cartoons, jokes, and funny or cute things the children said, items that simultaneously went up on our bulletin board. As with my mother, I hoped humor would be therapeutic, knowing that Norman Cousins credited laughter with curing him from cancer. We also sent Christmas poinsettias. In subsequent telephone conversations, Dad said Teresa was very supportive and always at his side. She'd only known my father a short while, and already their life together had taken an unfortunate turn with the onset of his illness. He sounded tired, wrung out from the treatments. The processes were draining his strength, and he had difficulty sleeping well, even with medication. And I heard more than fatigue in his voice. No matter how he tried to get around it, depression was weighing him down.
It tugged at my heart to hear this terrible, debilitating emotion in his voice, and I knew it was from more than the physical rigors of hyperthermia and chemotherapy.
For some time he had not been able to write, and this was a man whose psychological well-being depended upon his ability to create. But I heard something else in his voice as well, and this gave me pause for hope. No matter how tired my father sounded, no matter how slowly his words came, he was always struggling to be upbeat, fighting to sound cheerful. A constant air of excitement surrounded him. There were new directions Frank Herbert wanted to explore, new worlds to conquer and write about. I sensed that he was reaching for something deep inside. This man who was no stranger to working long hours. Reaching for something to keep alive. The book that was his own remarkable life. Chapter 45. How Bare the Pathway Down This Mountain. As I look back on it, I think there may have been some prescience in my father, too. Frank Herbert, in Dune. I spoke with my father in the morning and again in the afternoon on December 28, 1985. He said he was under 140 pounds and feeling weak. After reading The Galleys on Man of Two Worlds, I wanted to insert more material into a war scene on Venus, and we discussed what I would include.
He returned to Seattle from Wisconsin on January 5, 1986, having completed 4 hyperthermia treatments and the same number of chemotherapy treatments.
On the flight back, he and his young wife happened to be on the same plane with science fiction author and editor Frederick Pohl. I met Mr. Pohl at the airport for a brief time, before he hurried off in one direction, and I went with my father and Teresa in another. The doctors reported that he was doing well, but he looked very thin, down to 132 pounds. He had his coat off for a while, and I noticed around the short sleeves of his navy blue pullover shirt that his arms were still muscular, though much less bulky than before. Able to carry heavy luggage without difficulty, he stood erectly and walked briskly, with astonishing energy. His eyes were the familiar eyes, but older and sadder. His smile, like my mother's when she was so sick, was wan and distant. Dad said he would be checking into Swedish Hospital in Seattle for 2 weeks, where they would monitor his condition and build up his weight and strength for the next round of treatments in Wisconsin, scheduled to begin January 19th. He spoke of his aversion to hospital food, as my mother had done before him. It saddened me to think of my father, the gourmet and raconteur who had so captivated dinner table audiences over the years, unable to truly enjoy his meals. I thought of his deep, rolling laugh that used to fill every corner of a room, and wished I could hear it again. But now his laughter returned only intermittently, in bursts that were caught short by the grim reality of his struggle for survival. He no longer had his heart in the writing process. His life was too cluttered with bleak hospital corridors and little rooms with infernal machines, and men and women in white smocks with clipboard charts. These were as well constant and painful reminders of Beverly and her monumental suffering. I visited Dad regularly at Swedish Hospital, where I found him sitting up or lying in bed, with a catheter attached to his chest and tubes at his arms. He wore a pale green gown that emphasized how thin he had become. He had a bird-like appearance now, and this made me think of character descriptions in his stories, particularly in Dune, where the features were compared with those of hawks. I saw little of the hawk in him, however. This was a less aggressive bird, with sweetness and gentleness of disposition. Of course, there was the one time I appeared in the doorway of his hospital room with Kim. She had brought him a gift, but Dad went into an alarmed microphobia posture, dispatching her without even looking at what she had brought for him. Children carried too many germs, he said, and he couldn't risk having her near him. Kim, only 13, went to the waiting room, her feelings hurt. She got over it when Jan, Teresa, and I explained to her that her grandfather loved her very much, and that he may even have been correct from a medical standpoint. Now he was as thoughtful as anyone could be, asking about us and about his grandchildren, inquiring how they were doing in school, what their special interests were. I wanted the laughter to return to his heart and voice, wanted him back to his normal self, driving everybody crazy around him. I hated seeing him so subdued and devoid of his former spirit. In what had become a family tradition, albeit one I wished had never been necessary, I took him jokes and humor bits from my funny files. There were also handmade cards from Jan and Julie, short stories from Kim, and drawings from Margot to her pop-pop. At Swedish Hospital, Dad was at first quite pale, but as days passed and he received care, the color returned to his features and he put on a few pounds. Like his old self, he monitored his vital signs constantly, and the medical personnel were quite open with him about everything. The signs were good, especially considering his age and what he had been through. Dad spoke of how well the first round of treatments had gone in Wisconsin, and of how much he looked forward to returning to work on Dune 7. The new book was barely underway when he had to leave it. He said we might work on a Dune book together one day, perhaps a Dune prequel idea I had suggested to him, set in the mythical time of the Butlerian Jihad. He said my writing had come a long way. He had his up-and-down days, and seemed to want me to stay longer when he was feeling good. Perhaps this was the opposite of the way it should have been, for I might have lifted his spirits on down days, given enough time. Overall, he was upbeat, far more cheerful than the rest of us. Teresa was almost always there, either in the room or in a nearby waiting room, and I knew it was difficult for her. She and my father had made many plans, and had only been married for a few months. On January 10th, 1986, a Friday, I parked my car near Swedish Hospital and walked a couple of blocks, leaning into a cold, wind-driven drizzle. Moments later, in the warmth of my father's private hospital room, he was sitting up and alert. He recounted a number of Zen parables, some of which I recalled hearing before, emanating from his conversations in the 1960s with Zen master Alan Watts. One was the tale of a Zen priest and a young proselyte in his tutelage, both celibate. Walking alongside a river in India, they encountered a beautiful young woman in a white gown, moaning that she couldn't get across the water to her wedding without spoiling her dress. Upon hearing this, the priest carried her across while she lifted her skirts above the water. Then the holy man and his young associate continued on their way. Soon it became clear to the priest that something was troubling his companion, so he asked what it might be. "We've taken vows of celibacy," the youth answered, "but that beautiful woman, I must confess, she tempted me sorely." "Oh, you're still carrying that young woman? I left her back at the river." As if to sum up the folly of existence, including his own, Dad told another Zen parable. "Before I achieved Satori, sudden enlightenment, a mountain was a mountain, a river was a river, and a tree was a tree. After I achieved Satori, a mountain was still a mountain, a river was still a river, and a tree was still a tree." He seemed at ease with himself this day, full of smiles and good cheer, and I left with a powerful thought. Dad's going to beat this. His laughter was returning. He was upbeat, felt he was winning the battle. Dad knew that the power of the mind could defeat the ills of the body. In his domain, the mind ruled supreme. On January 15th, 1986, I wrote in my journal that I had been experiencing excruciating pain, radiating from my neck to my shoulders. I couldn't turn my head to the side, and when working on Prisoners of Arion, I had to set up a music stand behind my typewriter for the material I was retyping, so that I could look straight ahead. It was difficult jogging as well, but I ran in pain. A physical therapist wasn't of much help to me at all. On January 17th, one of Dad's last days at Swedish Hospital before leaving for Wisconsin, I visited him and showed him the cover art for my soon-to-be-released Berkeley paperback, Sudana, Sudana. It depicted a Picasso-like man on an alien world, with a powerful wind blowing his cape. My father showed great enthusiasm for it, said it was very striking and different from most science fiction covers. He returned to Madison on the 19th, ready to strike a final blow against the illness. Teresa accompanied him. I spoke with my father by telephone that day, and 2 days later. In the second conversation, he filled me in on his medical condition and treatments. He spoke of cancer in his pancreas, colon, and liver, and his words were a blur to me. It was hard for me to discuss this, and he detected my depressed mood. "I don't want people around me to prepare for the worst, Brian," he said. "It's under control. Really, it is." I said I knew he was strong, and that I was fine, that it was only the long-distance telephone wires making me sound that way. Just before midnight on Friday, January 24th, Penny telephoned, crying. She said Dad had taken a sudden turn for the worse. During surgery, the doctors had found extensive cancer, much more than expected. She was catching the first plane to Wisconsin to be with him. I telephoned Madison, but couldn't get any more information. I didn't know why my father had suddenly gone into surgery, but it sounded very bad. My mind went numb. I decided to get there the only way I could, by driving. How many miles was it? Around 2,000, I thought. It was the middle of the night in the dead of winter, during one of the worst cold snaps on record, with snow, ice, and record low temperatures across the heart of the country. Wisconsin, My destination had sub-freezing temperatures and icy roads. I packed hurriedly, throwing things into a small travel bag, and of all things, a cardboard box. I couldn't find any other luggage, didn't have time to look for it. By 1:30 a.m., I was driving north on Mercer Island, heading for the interstate. As I reached Interstate 90 and headed east, I fought back tears, vowing I would be with my father in his time of need, that there would be no repetition of what had happened with my mother. I cursed myself for not being able to fly. A full moon was out, casting a cold glow on snowy mountain peaks ahead of me in the rugged Cascades. The mountain where my parents had honeymooned as Forest Service lookouts was in that range, to the south. The highway was slick, and I had to keep my speed under 50 miles per hour. I made several stops along the way to telephone Jan and check on Dad's condition, but didn't obtain any new information. At 11 a.m. the next day, without sleep, I reached Missoula, Montana, nearly 500 miles from home. Now I learned from a phone call to Jan that Dad was fine, that he had undergone surgery and was in satisfactory condition. Apparently, the earlier reports from his doctor had been incorrect. He was sitting up in bed in good spirits, wondering what all the fuss was about. Penny and Teresa were with him, and Dad wanted me to turn around and go home. Jan said Bruce was on a trip and she could not reach him. Bill Ransom, however, had been in touch with her, and he was offering to fly ahead and meet me in Billings, Montana, to help with the driving. Our earlier plan had been for Jan to do this. I felt somewhat foolish, with 1,500 miles still to drive in some really treacherous weather and terrible road conditions. I was developing a cough and checked into a motel to sleep the rest of the day and await further developments. By the following morning, I received confirmation that Dad was doing extremely well. Through Jan, I passed word to Penny and Bill Ransom that I was heading home. It was 11 degrees in Montana that morning, with a pale blue sky and sunlight sparkling on ice alongside the roadway. It was so cold that the ice didn't melt from the hood of my car for 100 miles. By Monday, the 27th, I was back on Mercer Island, still behind on my sleep, with a hacking cough. Penny telephoned from Madison to say that Dad was up and walking around. Doctors were shaking their heads in disbelief, saying no one else recovering from that surgery had ever walked before 5 days. He was up in 3. When I spoke with my father that evening, he sounded chipper. In all the confusion, I didn't understand what his surgery had been all about, but assumed it must have been exploratory in nature, or perhaps to cut away some of the cancer cells as an additional treatment. In the process of this surgery, Dad said he had received a vertical incision from his chest to his midsection. He said it rather matter-of-factly, leaving me impressed by his courage. I was doubly impressed when I learned that before going into surgery, Dad asked his doctors and nurses how long it took other patients to recover. He wanted to know what the record was, and earlier he had asked similar questions with respect to the chemotherapy and hyperthermia treatments. With each answer he received, he tried to beat what other patients had done. He insisted on having his morphine dosage cut in half, was out of bed in half the time it took other patients. He was using his competitive nature in a new way. The following morning, January 28, 1986, Dad was watching the launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger on television, broadcast from Cape Canaveral, Florida. When the shuttle exploded in the sky, killing all aboard, Dad was terribly upset and started shaking. His doctor made him turn the TV off. Still, as days passed, Dad sounded better each time I talked with him. He was sweet and appreciative of my calls. He assured me that the cancer was in remission, that he was completing the round of treatments that had already been scheduled in order to play it safe. When she was sure Dad was all right, Penny flew back to Port Townsend. This provided the rest of us with additional reassurance, and we looked forward to seeing him in February. In my household and in telephone conversations with my brother and sister, we commented that his recovery was absolutely amazing. He needed to complete his treatments, but the indications were clear. He had the cancer on the run. At 7 o'clock in the evening on Friday, February 7th, 1986, I telephoned Dad and asked how he was doing. He said great, that he had a new laptop computer and tape recorder in his room, and he was writing a short story about his dream experiences while under anesthesia. It was, I would learn later from Bill Ransom, the beginnings of the soul-catcher-like story that my father had been seeking for several years. His dreaming mind had come up with something the conscious mind could not produce. He also composed an essay for Writers of the Future, an anthology of short stories by talented new writers. He was always willing to share his knowledge with others, even when he was fighting for his life. In that essay, he wrote, "Remember how you learned, and when your turn comes, teach." My father and I talked about a new movie contract that had been sent to him for one of his novels, The Green Brain. Then he paused for a moment and said, in the gentlest of tones, "We were in Hawaii a year ago, weren't we?" "Yes," I said. "I'll bet it's beautiful there, and warm." "I wish I were in the tropics right now, Brian. It's too cold here for my blood." We didn't specifically mention what day it was, the second anniversary of my mother's death, and the first anniversary of her ceremony at Kalaloa, but I knew it was on his mind, that he had never, despite all the changes in his life, forgotten the love he felt for my mother. At the close of the conversation, I said, "I love you, Dad." "I love you, too," he said. They would be the last words we would ever exchange. 4 days later, I was taking care of Margot, who was playing in a room upstairs. I was at the dining room table with my Prisoners of Arion manuscript spread out in front of me, writing a chapter in longhand. Shortly before noon, the Mercer Island police knocked at my door. A uniformed officer told me my sister had been trying to reach me and that something was wrong with my telephone. He said it was urgent and left. From the telephone in my study, I was able to dial Port Townsend. My heart was pounding through my chest. She was crying and gave me the shocking news that Dad had died of a pulmonary embolism, a blood clot that lodged in his lung, blocking the flow of blood. We spoke of his many attributes. I learned later that Dad had been working on a story with the new computer on his lap when suddenly he called for a nurse and said he wasn't feeling well. He had been in a cheerful mood, happy to be writing again. It was shortly before 11:30 a.m. Like my mother, who accurately predicted many years earlier that she would die in a distant land, Dad had predicted, back in the 1960s, that he would pass away at a keyboard, typing out a story. It is clear that Frank Herbert leaned toward the scientific and away from the occult, and that he wanted to believe in a universe that was based upon analytically provable premises. He was not one to have faith in the existence of a supreme creator. This is not to say that he ruled out the possibility of paranormal events. He had experimented with Rhine consciousness in the 1930s and had shown intense interest in Jung's theory of the collective unconscious. My father relied upon gut feelings and depended upon the abilities of a white witch, my mother. Some people assume that the remarkably accurate predictions in Frank Herbert's stories were made purely on the basis of reason and genius, linked with a process of intensive research and analysis. After all, it doesn't require occult talents to accurately predict shortages of finite resources on this planet and fallen heroes. It is significant to note, however, that he never argued with my mother when she prepared astrological charts before making important decisions. In fact, he walked the fence when it came to astrology, as can be seen in the dedication he wrote for the book Eclipse by Brian Brewer, 1978. It is well to remember that more than half the Earth's human population still uses astrology as a guide in the making of decisions. There is a possibility that a kernel of truth remains at the core of this ancient belief. We are Earth creatures. It would be remarkable if the rhythms that influence this planet where we evolved produced no effects on our flesh comparable to the influences upon our religions and philosophies. When we look at the heavens, we look at a cosmic clock that has marked every evolutionary development upon this mundane surface. That clock is still ticking. After talking with Penny, I sat in my study in stunned disbelief. Margot wandered in and looked at me quizzically, intending to tell her that Pop-Pop had died. I held my arms out and asked her to come to me. But she held back, as if sensing I was going to tell her something terrible. She approached eventually and stood close. I couldn't put the awful event into words. "I really love you, honey," I said. "You're so sweet. I'm glad you're here with me. Do you know that?" She smiled, the toothy grin of a 4-year-old, and rested a small hand on my knee. A reviewer for the New York Times once quipped that Frank Herbert's head was so overloaded with ideas that it was likely to fall off. In God Emperor of Dune, my father described Leto II, who through genetic processes had acquired all human information. In Pack Rat Planet and Direct Descent, Dad wrote of a vast galactic library, a storehouse containing the written wisdom of humankind. Frank Herbert, like Leto II and the Galactic Library, was a repository of incredible, wondrous information. His words captivated millions of people all over the world. He had worked so hard, but suddenly, in the ugly wretch of a pulmonary embolism, it was all taken from him, and from us. I was struck with the utter horrible waste of it, and I was angry. I thought as well of the poignant passage written by his friend Ray Bradbury in Fahrenheit 451 concerning an old sculptor who died. He was part of us, and when he died, all the actions stopped dead, and there was no one to do them just the way he did. He was an individual. He was an important man. I've never gotten over his death. Often I think, what wonderful carvings never came to birth because he died. During my mother's final years, Dad had been frustrated by the primitive level of medical knowledge about dietary matters and by the scarcity of low-salt foods for her. He had taken her to Mexico for Laetril, seeking what he thought was the latest, most effective cure for her. In his own 11th hour, he had searched a computer network for the technology needed to save his life, and had gone across the country to participate in an experimental program. If only my mother had been able to receive a heart transplant, a technology Dad wasn't confident about at the time, and if only he had been able to secure a cancer cure for himself. In another future time, both of them might have lived many years beyond the onset of their illnesses. So many things I wished for them. My parents were fighters. Mom beat her cancer and ultimately succumbed to heart disease. Dad had his cancer in remission, only to be struck down by an embolism. I wished I had done more for them, a feeling that haunted and paralyzed me. It's been said that we all have 20/20 hindsight. It's only natural to wish, to regret, to want to revisit old pathways, doing better the second time around. I wish I had been with my mother and father when they died, to offer comfort. But in this life, you can't totally prepare for anything. Events rarely occur the same way twice. I didn't expect my mother to die. She was too much of a fighter, and Dad told me she was improving. I didn't expect my father to die either. He was too strong and vibrant, too optimistic to lose his life prematurely. He was like a mountain climber going up the tough side of a peak and then falling off the easy side. It wasn't expected. We thought he would climb other mountains. I didn't cry when I first heard about Dad, though in my anger and disbelief I trembled and felt glassy-eyed. In a daze, I made a number of telephone calls, including one to Jack and Norma Vance. "I'll raise an empty glass for him," Jack said, his voice breaking as he referred to an Irish tradition, saluting the warrior who has not returned from battle. Very few of Dad's friends and business associates knew about the nature and severity of his illness. So for them, too, his passing came as a shock. While running an errand later that afternoon, I saw Jan in our other car and motioned her over in a school parking lot. There we stood outside, and I told her what had happened. Like me, she was in shock, but unlike me, she burst immediately into tears. to the point where she had trouble driving home. Later that day, I returned to the table in the dining room, where my manuscript pages were still spread. I don't know why I sat there with the thought of going back to work, but I did. Maybe I thought my father would have wanted me to keep writing. It was the craft he had taught me. My thoughts were fuzzy. I lifted pen to paper, but all I could write was, "My father died today." I still had not cried for him. The next day, Jan and I were in line at the post office. We reached the counter, and by that time a long line of people had gathered behind us. The clerk, a sweet woman named Agnes, had heard about the tragedy on the news and was telling me how sorry she was. Without warning, the terrible immensity of it overcame me, and I broke down in tears. Outside in the car, I asked Jan, "Why in the post office? Why?" Then it dawned on me. The mails had been our lifeline, our instrument of survival when I lived with Dad. He mailed manuscripts to his agent and watched mail deliveries carefully because checks, contracts, and important letters arrived that way. For him, especially during the early years of creative struggle, the postal system represented hope more than anything else. His hope for the arrival of good news about a story. Bruce's homosexuality had never been fully accepted by my father, and they had never reached full rapprochement. Still, when my brother came to Seattle, he broke into tears while riding in the back seat of my car. Penny and Jan consoled him. My brother told me later that he didn't cry from love, because he didn't feel he loved the man. He said he cried from what he had never experienced in the relationship with his father. "I missed almost everything," Bruce said. "I never saw the good side he showed to you. He wasn't there for me." He went on to say that he couldn't watch movies or television programs having to do with father-son relationships because they upset him so much. I told him that Dad loved him, that he spoke of him often and fondly, and that he just didn't know how to show it. I reminded Bruce of all the ways that he emulated our father, and of the many interests that they shared. Electronics, computers, science fiction, photography, flamenco guitar. And I asked if that could possibly mean that he loved Dad after all. My brother fell silent. I told him that love is a complicated equation, fraught with countless different motives and angles of interpretation. One person's definition does not correspond with another's. Everyone would agree, however, that it is a strong bond of affection. I am convinced that Bruce felt this for his father. My telephone rang off the hook, reporters from all over the country, but I refused all interview requests. I found myself unable to talk with any of them. I had images in my mind of grief-stricken family members on the 5 o'clock news, sitting on a couch under the hot glare of TV lights, fielding insensitive questions from intruders. Instead, I suggested that anyone wishing to do so could send donations to the Frank Herbert Cancer Research Fund at the University of Wisconsin Medical Center. Frank Herbert was brilliant, loving, honest, loyal, generous, and thoughtful. His deficiencies were more interesting than significant. In the days and months after my father's passing, I experienced more apparent grief for him than for my mother. I felt a terrible emptiness. In moments of privacy and silence, or during conversation, I would suddenly be overwhelmed with emotion, and it confounded me. Perhaps it was because we grieved for Mom over a long 10-year period during her illness. We were conditioned to expect her death. But with Dad, it had been so nightmarishly sudden and shocking. He was such a survivor, such a larger-than-life figure. I thought he could beat anything. All say his day had ended. How bare the pathway down this mountain. Frank Herbert in Dune Messiah. Epilogue. We say of Muad'Dib that he has gone on a journey into that land where we walk without footprints. Frank Herbert, in Dune Messiah. My father made a mere 65 trips around the sun with this planet. Still, he crammed 1,000 years of living into his life. I was not there when he died, but I was there when he lived. And perhaps this is better, for I can remember him as he was, a remarkably alive person with such boundless energy and enthusiasm for life. Only one thing could stop this giant of a man prematurely, this creator of magnificent worlds. And that was losing my mother. Though none of us knew it, as she faded away, he was fading too. His own suffering was obvious to us, particularly after she was gone. But still, we hoped. There was always hope. After Mom died, several people, including myself, tried to fill in the gaping holes left in his life by her departure. But it wasn't enough to keep him whole. The sum total of all of us did not equal my mother. His heart had been shot away. Following Beverly Herbert's death, the only productive writing Dad did involved the fulfillment of promises made to her. He completed Chapter House Dune, and the collaboration with me, Man of Two Worlds. Additional projects either didn't come to fruition, screenplays on the Santa Rosa Barrier and Soul Catcher, or were left for others to finish, The Ascension Factor and other books in the Dune series. He also left undone a new collection of science fiction stories, which was to include a 20,000-word novella set in the Dune universe. The new short story collection was a contractual obligation to G.P. Putnam's Sons as part of a package deal that included the Dune 7 novel. Without his companion of nearly 4 decades, my father could not go on. I did not discover one of the terrible pieces of the puzzle until months after my father's death, when it was too late. For years there had been stories of surviving spouses dying shortly after the death of their loving companion. I always thought of it as a vague phenomenon, something nebulous, dying of a broken heart. But it was more than that, much more. It was tangible, with ugly teeth. Even the onset of a serious illness in a spouse could be dangerous to the mate, as in the case of Buckminster Fuller. Fuller was in good health, though elderly at 87. He suffered a fatal heart attack at the hospital bedside of his wife Anne while she was in a coma. She died 2 days afterward, reportedly without learning of his death. But I think she knew. After nearly 66 years of marriage, with the tremendously close bond the Fullers had, she knew. According to a Harvard Medical School article published in October 1986, entitled Depression and Immunity, bereavement, depression, and loneliness in the surviving spouse can cause the immune system to break down, making the survivor more susceptible to illness. In one of the obituaries on Dad, the writer said that Frank Herbert was condemned to sequelizing himself. I was furious upon reading it and shouted at the page that it wasn't true, that the needs of my mother forced him to write the sequels. There were astronomical costs for the construction of Kawaloa and for medical expenses that were not covered by insurance. After I calmed down, I realized the press could not be expected to understand my father's motivations. Even if they read the touching dedication to my mother in Chapter House Dune, they could not know the pain of this complex man, could not possibly know his innermost thoughts. A week after my father's death, we held a simple ceremony for him on the Olympic Peninsula, in a forest he loved, attended by family and friends. On a high spot of ground, in a small clearing with evergreen trees towering overhead, we dug a small hole and scattered his ashes in it. Pursuant to his wishes, we planted a young dwarf Macintosh apple tree there, and suddenly realized no one had watered the hole. At that moment, to our amazement, rain began to fall. Not unlike the rain at the end of the David Lynch film version of Dune that watered the parched planet. It was just enough water for the tree. In the mist, Bill Ransom read one of our favorite passages from Soul Catcher. Our brothers will sing of this. I will cover your body with white feathers from the breasts of ducks. Our maidens will sing your beauty. This is what you have prayed for from one end of the world to the other every day of your life. I give you your wish, because I have become Soul Catcher. And I remembered one of the Zen parables my father had told me shortly before his death. Before I achieved Satori, a mountain was a mountain, a river was a river, and a tree was a tree. After I achieved Satori, a mountain was still a mountain, a river was still a river, and a tree was still a tree. Now it seemed to me that the Satori he had been speaking of was the burst of enlightenment that he had been on this planet, a brief and brilliant flare of energy, a miniature sun with human frailties. Despite his achievements, he was tied inextricably to the human group, and its fate became his fate. As in American Indian thought, he had come full circle, and the end was like the beginning. A quarter century before, Frank Herbert wrote this unpublished poem. I am a human of earth. My kind ebb and flow like the tide, whipped on by an unseen master, myself a prisoner. My other side calls out from its prison. Logic binds me in chains of flesh. And with part of me chained, there is fear. I am a human of the earth. The sense comes out behind my words like a deer startled in the forest, fearing movement. Only one avenue remains open to flotsam, driven before the wild currents of time, with part submerged, to lift my eyes and look ahead. But bound down and weighted by the chained side, by the other side that I sought to deny, I must flounder, I must sink. I am a human of earth. In despair, I seek the farther shore, and the dark drags me down into terror. In The Good Earth, Pearl S. Buck wrote, men when old awake to a brief youth. So like my father, those words. He married a young woman, ordered a new Porsche, grew fond of popular music, took skin diving lessons, and made plans to climb magnificent peaks in the Himalayas. Late in life, Dad wanted to spend a year in Paris, wanted to direct a movie. There were unfinished story ideas, including more books with me and with Bill Ransom. He left loose ends, dreams uncompleted. Like the painter Jean Géricault at the end of his life, Frank Herbert spoke of all the things he would do when he was well again. And like Géricault, he never got well. In many ways, my father never grew up, and this was part of the charm of the man. Like a small boy, he always looked forward to his birthday, and to my mother bringing him back little gifts on the few occasions when she took plan-ahead business trips without him. In his youth, he had gone on a daring adventure all the way to Alaska in a small sailing canoe. Later, just before meeting my mother, he and his best friend, Howie Hansen, spoke of vagabonding around the world. He was an explorer at heart, an adventurer. He was forever curious. As fate would have it, the very last novel my father wrote was with me, the book my mother wanted us to do together, Man of Two Worlds. He never saw the completed first edition, though he did see the cover proof and typeset galleys. It was an emotional moment when I received copies of our book from the publisher shortly after Dad's death, especially when I saw the photograph of us together on the back. Teresa took the picture on his 65th birthday. His last. Frank Herbert and Bill Ransom worked on plotting and characterization for The Ascension Factor, but the writing had to be done by Bill after the death of his collaborator. A lifelong workaholic, he wrote with me on that day. More than half a century earlier, on his 8th birthday, he had written as well, after announcing to his family at breakfast that he wanted to be a author. In the final scene of Man of Two Worlds, written by Dad, the characters are planning a vacation in the Himalayas. Each time I read this, I think of my adventurous father and of his uncompleted trip to those mountains, the highest on Earth. He wanted to become the oldest man to climb Mount Everest. In June, a single green Macintosh apple appeared on the tree. I know my father, who always wanted to beat the odds and do better than the next guy, had something to do with this. The young tree, you see, was not supposed to bear fruit until the following year. On the cold February day that we scattered Dad's ashes, we held a wake for him in the Port Townsend house, at which we played Irish music and celebrated the remarkable life he had led. His friends and family were there from points near and far, and we drank the wines in his wine cellar. Grand Crus, Premier Crus, and even ordinary vintages. We drank all of the bottles of Chateau Prieuré Lichine Margaux. The following month, I was asked on very short notice to speak at two events in my father's behalf, both at the NorwestCon Science Fiction Convention in Seattle. One was an awards ceremony for the Writers of the Future contest, where Dad had judged stories written by aspiring writers. The contest organizers wanted me to address 400 people at a banquet. I had always been petrified at the thought of public speaking, but I got up and managed it. I felt my father's spirit there with me. He told me that the people in the audience were our friends. The other occasion was a showing of film clips on Frank Herbert and the making of the Dune movie. At first I told them I didn't think I could talk to all of the people who were gathered. Then I reconsidered, feeling strongly it was something I needed to do. I spoke about the film clips and about my father, and fielded questions from the audience. I was overwhelmed with a feeling of love and sorrow from his fans, and this gave me strength. Later in the year, a most remarkable event occurred. For many years, my mother had tried to re-establish contact with her childhood playmate and first cousin, Marie Landis. During all those years, Marie was also trying to reach my mother. But each was married, and in the process, their maiden names had been lost. They could not find one another. Then, after Dad died, Marie read in a science fiction magazine that Frank Herbert had been married to Beverly Stewart. Marie wondered if this could possibly be the same Beverly Stewart she had last seen in the 1930s, when they were children in Seattle, before an unfortunate argument created a rift between Marie's father and his sister, Beverly's mother. See Chapter 4. My mother was born Beverly Stewart, but changed her maiden name to Forbes later, after her mother remarried. Marie began bird-dogging, and finally made contact with me several months after Dad's death. It turned out that she lived on my street on Mercer Island. It was a rather long street, more than 5 miles, and we were only 3 miles apart. Every weekday, for 7 years, I had driven by her house commuting to my job at the insurance agency. My parents passed her house many times as well, while coming to visit me or looking for real estate on the island. Marie was an accomplished painter, as my maternal grandmother Marguerite had been. Marie was also a potter and interior designer like Jan, and of great interest to me, she was an excellent writer, having won several awards for her short stories. We began collaborating, and sold a science fiction novel, Memory Makers, 1991. Numerous short story collaborations followed, and another novel, Blood on the Sun, 1996. Through Marie, I met many cousins I had been totally unaware of, including her siblings and children. Following such tremendous losses, when I was grieving terribly, a whole new loving family opened up for me. Then, 11 years after the death of my father, I began to consider the possibility of writing new Dune novels in collaboration with the noted science fiction author Kevin J. Anderson. For more details on our collaboration, refer to the afterword of Dune: House Atreides by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson. We were trying to figure out what Dad had in mind for Dune 7, the book he was just beginning to think about when he passed away. That novel would have been a direct sequel to Heretics of Dune and Chapter House Dune. Dune, Dune Messiah, and Children of Dune formed a trilogy. God Emperor of Dune was a bridging work to a new trilogy that included Heretics of Dune and Chapter House Dune. Dune 7, only a working title that would eventually be changed, was to be the third book of that trilogy. In Chapter House Dune, the Honored Maters, the dark side of the Bene Gesserit, were laying waste to much of the galaxy, destroying planets, killing our Bene Gesserit heroines, driving them back. But something else was out there in the galaxy as well. Something terrible that was chasing the Honored Maters. And Frank Herbert did not reveal what it was. He left us with a tantalizing mystery. A short while after beginning my discussions with Kevin, I was contacted by an estate attorney and informed of the existence of two safety deposit boxes that had belonged to my father. For years they had slipped under the proverbial radar screen and had been languishing in a bank vault in Bellevue, Washington. An attorney inventoried the contents of the boxes and found old-style computer disks and comprehensive notes on Dune 7, the grand finale of the series. This was a tremendous surprise to all of us, since we didn't know that my father had made any notes at all. As if this was not enough, we subsequently located more than 1,500 pages of working notes that Dad had been using to write the entire series. Notes that were in manuscript boxes inside a storage room. With all of the events unfolding around me, I recognized the handiwork of my mother, Beverly Herbert. The White Witch who gave me life, who loved and nurtured my entire family, was continuing to do so. I felt comforted in her presence.
This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this full-length reading of Dreamer of Dune, the biography of Frank Herbert by Brian Herbert. Recorded by arrangement with Tom Doherty Associates, LLC, a division of Tor Books. Text copyright 2003 by Brian Herbert. Production copyright 2022 by Scott Brick Productions, Incorporated. All rights reserved. If you enjoyed Dreamer of Dune, we encourage you to explore the Dune universe by Frank Herbert and the expanded Dune universe by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, available wherever you find your audiobooks. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.